Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
You know, we often see entertainers really drill down, right? Become absolute masters of just one thing, stand-up, maybe acting, maybe music. But Eric Griffin's career, well, it seems to kind of zigzag across all those lines, stand-up, TV, films, and now he's huge in podcasting too. So what do the sources tell us? Is there a strategy there? What's behind building this really diverse career across so many different mediums?
That's a fantastic question, and it's really what we want to unpack in this deep dive today. We've pulled together some really compelling sources. It's mainly a detailed profile on Eric Griffin, drawing from interviews, biographical info, that kind of thing. And this lets us, you know, connect the dots, look at his origins, the decisions he made, those breakout roles, and how his career sort of evolved across comedy, film, TV, and audio too. What's really fascinating, I think, is how all these different pieces, they paint this picture of like consistent growth and adaptation. It looks less like lucky breaks and more like, well, like a plan, like architecture almost, built on hard work, sharp observation, and really understanding how to use his voice everywhere.
Right. And for you listening, this dive into Eric Griffin, it's more than just one comedian story. It's really a great case study in how careers can evolve, how you find and maybe refine your own voice. And how crucial it is to leverage different platforms today, you know, in the modern entertainment world. It kind of challenges that old idea of just staying in your lane, doesn't it?
Right, yeah.
Shows how someone can build this multifaceted career pretty much from scratch, using different mediums, not just to get somewhere, but as part of the expression itself. It really highlights knowing your strengths. And then this is the key part, finding new ways to apply them everywhere. Okay, so to really get Eric Griffin's path, we kind of go back to the beginning. Because often those seeds for later success, they're planted in pretty unexpected places. Eric Griffin was born March 12, 1972, right there in Los Angeles, California. Now, when you hear born in L.A., you might picture someone, you know, destined for Hollywood from day one. Maybe they had connections, an easy path. But Griffin's journey, it was anything but a straight line. Not at all. Being born there just put him geographically close. How he actually navigated that world? Well, that's the whole story. It shows talent can find its way through some winding roads.
Yeah, and if you look closer at those early years, his background is really unique, and it definitely shaped him and the comedian he became. He was raised by his mother, who was an immigrant from Belize, and notably, he never met his father. That's not just like a biographical footnote. It feels foundational. Think about the cultural perspective, the observations, the maybe resilience that comes from that kind of upbringing, growing up in LA, but with that strong Belizean heritage link through his mom. That creates this rich, sometimes contrasting tapestry of experience, that cultural duality. It gives him a unique lens. And that lens is basically a gold mine for observational comedy. The everyday stuff, the differences in perspective, just navigating those two worlds, it doesn't just give him material. It forges this really distinct comedic voice. It's authentic because it's grounded in real life. It shapes how he sees things and how he says it. Makes it specific, but still really relatable.
That's a really interesting point. And the sources say, before he even thought about comedy clubs, before stand-up was even on the radar, Eric Griffin was in a totally different world. He worked at a school, coaching basketball, doing office work. That's quite a contrast, isn't it? Coaching kids, admin tasks, then the raw energy of a comedy stage. It's easy now to say, oh, he was just gathering material. But what do the sources say about that actual decision? Leaving a stable job for, let's face it, the total uncertainty of stand-up. Was there, like, a trigger? A specific moment, or was it more gradual? Because honestly, that leap sounds terrifying. Understanding that courage could tell us a lot.
Well, the sources suggest it wasn't really a sudden aha moment. It was more of a profound, deliberate pivot, which, yeah, shows incredible courage. It points to this growing belief in his own comedic voice, something that must have been building up. And that time at the school, it wasn't just a placeholder job. It was, maybe without him realizing it, kind of an apprenticeship in observation, in human behavior. I mean, think about it, the daily interactions, right? Different students, parents, the weirdness of school rules, stuff on the basketball court. You have to command attention, manage different personalities, read a room. These aren't just stories. They're basically master classes in understanding people, group dynamics, timing, whether it's poaching or, you know, a witty comment. These experiences, even if they seem ordinary, they directly sharpened his observational skills, his ability to know when to say something. Those are the exact skills you need on a stand-up stage. So taking that leap in 2003, it wasn't just ditching one job for another. It was recognizing that the skills he'd accidentally built up were exactly what he needed for comedy. It wasn't about finding a new him. It was about giving the him that was already there a different, maybe better platform.
Wow, reframing that school job as an unwitting apprenticeship. That's powerful. It gives you, the listener, a really valuable insight. If you ever feel stuck somewhere that seems unrelated to your goals, it's not always about finding a totally new you. It's about spotting those core skills you already have, like his eye for detail, his timing, and seeing how they might fit somewhere else, even if it feels like a detour. It's about seeing the connections between your different experiences, not just seeing them as separate things.
Exactly. That school experience gave him so much material, sure, but also that deep understanding of people. It's invaluable for a comedian. Such a contrast to Hollywood glamour, but it directly informed his perspective, made it grounded, relatable. So with all that background, the life experiences, the skills he was honing without maybe even realizing it, it's not really a surprise that when he finally jumped into stand-up in 2003, his style naturally leaned towards observational comedy. It wasn't just picking a genre. It felt like the perfect, almost inevitable outlet for the unique way he saw the world.
Yeah, that's a key point. A lot of people think observational comedy is just, you know, pointing out funny things. But someone like Griffin, you can see there's an architecture to it. It's not just what he says, it's how. There's the setup, the misdirection sometimes, and then that punchline that just hits because it feels so true, often reveals something deeper about us. And given his background immigrant household, the school job absurdity, it makes total sense he'd excel at this. He's pulling directly from real life. The cultural stuff, the daily grind, things we all notice but maybe don't articulate. He has that knack for distilling those specific moments into something universal and hilarious. And his delivery, right, that deadpan, often kind of exasperated look, that's a huge tool in this style. It lets the audience connect their own experiences to his. It's where the really resonant humor comes from because it's rooted in truth. Makes his stand-up not just funny, but insightful, too. Now, for a lot of people listening, probably their first real encounter with Eric Griffin was Montez Walker on Comedy Central's Workaholics.
That role, it ran for 6 seasons, 2011 to 2017. That didn't just put him on the map. It kind of stamped him into people's minds. Montez wasn't just, like, a side character. He quickly became this beloved, essential, often scene-stealing part of the show. Griffin just nailed that specific deadpan, always annoyed humor. He embodied that guy, the cubicle neighbor, constantly irritated by the main guys, but somehow still involved. For years, a lot of people probably just thought of him as Montez. It really speaks to consistency and finding that perfect project where your specific talents, that dry wit, that timing can just shine.
And it was definitely that breakout role as Montez, capturing that really distinct persona that did more than just entertain. Critically, it opened doors for him beyond sitcoms. That visibility was huge. It meant casting directors, producers, they saw him not just as the funny guy from Workaholics, but as an actor with real presence. But while Workaholics obviously launched him, did the sources mention any struggle with being so tied to one character? Did he have trouble convincing people he could do other things? Or was the transition smoother because Montez was just so well played?
That's a really good question. It's a classic challenge, right? When you play such a memorable character, the sources seem to suggest that, yeah, the recognition was priceless, but showing his range took some deliberate effort. It wasn't like he was completely typecast, maybe, but the industry often needs to see you do something different before they fully buy in. And this is exactly where we see him start to broaden things out, beyond the Workaholics comedy zone. In 2015, while Workaholics was still going, he gets cast as Ralph Carnegie in I'm Dying Up Here. That was the Showtime series, a drama about the LA stand-up scene in the 70s. Totally different kind of role. He wasn't just playing funny. He was playing a comedian within a drama, exploring the struggles, the scene, the darker side of comedy. And that's kind of meta, isn't it? Playing someone grappling with the same art form you do. Did the sources talk about that? Like how playing a comedian from a different era might have, I don't know, influenced his own comedy or given him new perspectives?
Yeah, the sources do suggest that I'm Dying Up Here was a pretty significant experience for him. It gave him this unique chance to really think about comedy itself. it wasn't just acting. It was like a deep dive into the history, the crucible, where modern stand-up was formed. Playing a 70s comedian, that era had so much creativity, but also real hardship. It let him connect with the struggles of comedians who came before him, but on a deeper level. He probably used his own experience as the grind, finding your voice, but had to filter it through that 70s lens with its own cultural issues and industry challenges. And that process, the sources hint, it deepened his appreciation for the art, helped him understand stand-up beyond just his own journey. It would have made him think about what's universal in the comedy struggle versus what was specific to that time, added layers to his own craft. Uh-huh. And then beyond that, he also had roles in Blunt Talk, another series with a different kind of satirical tone. These were really crucial moves. They showed different sides of his acting, proved he could do more than just Montez Walker's humor, and signaled he was ready for more complex roles, both comedy and drama.
And then from TV, he makes the jump to the big screen, adds another really important layer to his career, getting cast in films like Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates in 2016 and then Murder Mystery in 2019. That shows his versatility, his appeal to a wider movie audience. Moving to film, it's not just a different medium, it's a chance to show comedic timing on a bigger scale. Often needs maybe a bit more subtlety than sitcom work. In Mike and Dave, for instance, his role wasn't huge, but it felt essential. It kind of grounded the film's wildness, like his reactions to the main character's craziness. He wasn't just saying lines, he was being the audience's exasperation. He'd steal scenes with just a look or a sigh. He was like this anchor of normal in all the chaos. And the Murder Mystery, being there with Adam Sandler, Jennifer Aniston, huge names. He held his own in that big ensemble, adapted his deadpan style to fit that broader, maybe more slapstick vibe. It proved his comedy could work in blockbusters, that his observational wit could shine in different movie settings, really cemented him as a recognizable comedic actor in Hollywood.
Right. And while all this acting success is building on TV and in film, Eric Griffin is also very intentionally building his stand-up career at the same time. What's really interesting is how well-timed it seems. The synergy between his rising TV profile and his big stand-up moments, he clearly used that workaholic's visibility strategically. He records a half-hour special for Comedy Central February 28, 2013. That's a big deal for any comic getting that national platform. And that special, it wasn't just jokes. It was like a clear statement of who he was as a comedian, separate from Montez. Then later that same year, he drops his first stand-up album, Technical Fell, Volume 1. And he released it on his birthday, March 12th. That's a nice personal touch, right? Makes it memorable, reinforces his brand. And the title, Technical Foul, kind of hints at his style calling out the ridiculous fouls in life. So that period, 2013, it looks like this major surge of creativity and a really cool strategy to make sure people knew him not just as an actor, but as Eric Griffin, the stand-up comedian with his own unique voice and material. It shows a real conscious effort to build his stand-up cred and connect directly with his audience.
And that stand-up momentum just kept rolling. He makes that big leap from Comedy Central to Showtime, which, yeah, for a stand-up, that's a major step up. Platform, prestige, reach, all of it. Premiering two full specials, Eric Griffin, The Ugly Truth in July 2017, and then American Warrior in June 2018, both on Showtime. That says a lot. It's not just getting one shot. It's getting booked again, showing his perspective really connected, enough for a premium network known for top talent to want more. And releasing two specials like that, basically within a year. That's a clear sign his stand-up career was really hitting its peak. Huge demand for his voice, his material, the titles too. The Ugly Truth, American Warrior, they suggest maybe he's tackling bigger themes, maybe with more edge, but still grounded in that observational style. These specials let him go deeper, reach a huge audience, and really cement his reputation as a serious force in stand-up. Showed he belonged on those big stages.
Absolutely. And then beyond the stage and screen, Eric Griffin makes this really smart, successful move into podcasting, which again shows how entertainment is changing and how artists adapt. Starting around 2022, he becomes a regular guest host on King and the Sting and Wing. That was the show with Brendan Schaub, Theo Vaughn, and Christy Ilya had joined. This move really highlights how entertainers are diversifying, right? They see these direct-to-audience audio platforms offer this unique connection. Podcasting lets you be maybe more raw, more conversational, less scripted than TV, even less polished than stand-up sometimes. And being a regular guest on an already popular show like that, that would have given him massive exposure to a whole new audience, people who maybe didn't know him from TV or his specials. He brought this distinct, often kind of dry, grounding vibe to their dynamic, which could be pretty wild, showed his personality outside of a character, just reacting to things, telling stories. It's such a powerful way to build that connection, deepen your persona beyond just performing roles.
And the really compelling part of his podcast journey is he didn't just stay a guest. He became permanent. He stepped in as a co-host, replacing Theo Vaughn when the show got renamed The Golden Hour late in 2022. That's not a small thing, is it? It says so much about his chemistry, his contribution, his appeal within that specific podcast world. To go from regular guest to full-on co-host, basically an anchor for the show, that's a huge milestone in his podcasting career. It really shows how fluid these things can be in the digital space. If the chemistry's right and the audience connects, things can change fast. His ability to adapt his humor, his personality, to that unscripted long-form chat format, just work. Let him connect with listeners in a more ongoing, maybe intimate way. Becoming a co-host on The Golden Hour meant a bigger platform for his voice, his insights, made him a really influential player in the audio space.
Right. And then on top of being a key co-host on that big show, he also hosts his own podcast, Riffin' with Griffin, which, doing both, it raises an interesting question for any creative today. Why do both? Why co-host one popular show and also do your own solo thing? It really suggests this desire for, like, complete creative freedom, a platform to say exactly what he wants, maybe explore topics or talk to guests in a way that doesn't always fit the group dynamic. Riffin' with Griffin lets him totally steer the ship, dive into things maybe more personal or niche to him, and crucially, build his own distinct community. Listeners who are there specifically for his take on things. It's like an affirmation of his own creative vision, his commitment to connecting directly, gives him an even wider space for his observations and commentary, shows his creative drive is pretty boundless.
And his influence, it even goes beyond his own performances, stage, screen, mic. Eric Griffin's also popped up in documentaries about comedy itself. He was in Just Like Us back in 2010, that film about Arab American comedians. And then Funny, the documentary in 2017. Be included in those, it says something about his standing, the respect he has within the comedy community. These aren't just random appearances. It's like being asked to contribute to the history, the culture of comedy. It's not just about being funny. It's about being seen as someone with insight, a voice worth hearing in the conversation about the art form and its impact. His inclusion shows he's not just a performer, but a respected participant, someone whose perspective is valued when people try to capture what comedy is all about, really cements his status within that world. So after tracing all these threads, what does Eric Griffin's journey really mean for you, the listener? His story, it's more than just making it. It's like a masterclass in building a career piece by piece, strategically. He wasn't scared to pivot from that school job to the chaos of stand-up. Then he used that huge TV break, Montez, not just for fame, but to launch his own stand-up specials. Then he branched into film, showed range, and then smartly became this major voice in podcasting. He's carved out this totally unique space by consistently honing his observational style, his voice, and then, this is key, adapting and amplifying it across all these different platforms. His career really shows how an authentic voice combined with smart adaptation can find success everywhere, with each platform kind of feeding the others. It's synergistic.
Yeah, if you look at the big picture, Eric Griffin really embodies the modern entertainer. He's like a blueprint for navigating today's media world. He hasn't just stayed in one lane waiting for things to happen. He's actively, meticulously woven together acting, stand-up, writing, podcasting, using each one like a tool to boost his voice, reach different people, build this really strong, resilient personal brand. And what's so fascinating is how consistent he's stayed in his core style, that observational comedy, while tweaking it perfectly for all these different formats. It wasn't about changing himself for each platform. It was about understanding how to translate his strengths into new situations. He's proof that a strong, authentic voice that evolves with the media landscape, instead of being trapped by it, has lasting power. His journey is just this compelling model for how to use every opportunity and every medium to get your unique perspective out there. Makes him more than just a comedian. He's a true multimedia personality. And for you listening, this story offers something really powerful. Beyond just, you know, being inspired, it should make you think about your own career, your creative interests. How maybe taking a more varied, adaptive approach instead of sticking rigidly to one path could open up possibilities you haven't even thought of. It's about being open to trying new things, learning new skills, and really thinking hard about how your core talents, your real voice, can be applied or translated in different ways. The big lesson from Eric's journey isn't just trying stuff. It's understanding that those seemingly unrelated parts of your life, the boring jobs, the detours, they aren't distractions. They're often where your unique perspective, your voice, gets shaped. It's realizing your best insights might come from regular experiences, and then figuring out how to strategically share those insights where they'll resonate most.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? In this media world, it's changing constantly. Is it better for an artist, or really anyone, to go super deep in one thing, become the absolute master of that one craft? Or is it more valuable now to become a master of adaptation, to skillfully navigate lots of different platforms, different ways of expressing yourself, maybe ensuring you have more reach, more resilience? As you think about Eric Griffin's path, how do you see that playing out in your own life, your own work, your own creative journey in this complex, connected world we're all in?
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.